everybody. Time for another Shop Talk show. This is episode number 247, and I guess there's no use in keeping it a secret. This is a panel episode in which we're going to be talking about web performance. And web performance is such a huge topic these days. It has been for years. In fact, it's grown so big that it's well beyond just the normal stuff I think about with web performance, like optimizing your images and reducing requests and setting caching headers and stuff. I love that stuff. Important checklist performance stuff, but that's just a small piece of the pie these days. There's so many more things to talk about. So I thought we'd call this the performance equation and talk about more just different stuff that's also squarely in the realm of web performance, but just isn't the normal stuff we talk about every day, I guess. We're going to get all into that stuff in this episode. It is brought to you by, in part, Rollbar. That's rollbar.com. Totally vital error tracking software for your web app. Full stack error monitoring for apps in any language. It's amazing. You should definitely check it out. We're going to tell you more about it later in the show. Also, we're like 50-ish sold out the next few months on advertising on Shop Talk. There's still room for you. We'd love to have you go to shoptalkshow.com/advertising and look at the details for sponsoring this show. We would love to have you. For now, Mr. Dave, kick things off.
Hey there, Shopping Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm one of your co-hosts, a sickly Dave Rupert, hacking, coughing with Chris Coyer.
Dave's body performance is bad. And your computer's sick too? All right, is it having like empathy sickness for you?
Yeah,
is it
the other way around? I've had a lot of crashes. There's like an 80% chance I will green screen of death here mid-show. So don't worry about it, everyone. Chris, I've been thinking about the effects of Sudafed on the body and how it speeds up your heart rate. Do you think that's relevant to today's show here?
Oh, it is. I think. I never know what you're going to say, and then it's hard to react to it. Oh, it's
well,
like, almost like we should
Sudafed
be planning.
Sudafed is like a major ingredient in meth, I guess.
Right.
I don't really understand chemistry, but I'm feeling like an expert right about now.
Well, I would say that Sudafed is a part of the equation of health.
Okay.
Or something like that. Anyway, let me just get to it because everybody's anxious to know what we're here to talk about and who our guests are. We have a lot of them. It's going to be five people total talking today, so hopefully you can get us all straight. What we want to talk about is web performance. It's been a hot topic maybe forever, but definitely in the last couple of years. I think there's just a lot of talk about it in the just people that work on the web are excited about it. And, you know, there's data shooting around on how it's super important. When mobile started to get hot, that heated up the conversation even more. I'm sure 100% of the people that are listening to this show are aware that making your websites fast is a good idea, and beyond a good idea, like pretty vital to the success of a website these days. Am I right so far, Dave?
Yes, web performance is vital, but I think that your kind of idea, right? I don't want to spoil it too much. Web performance is such a big topic. It's like, you know, it's not just fix your images and turn on.
Well,
G-Zip
it used to
anymore.
Be. I feel like the checklist 2 years ago was like optimize your images, squish all your stuff together, send as few files as possible, maybe make a little spreadsheet so you don't get off track. It like used to feel pretty simple, you know, like check your headers, make sure you're setting far expires headers, and you're like, yeah, I can do this. And you'd get give yourself a back pat, a little A+. And all of a sudden performance is like, well, there's not only that, but there's service workers and progressive web apps and like psychological components and time to glass. And I don't know, like, it's like nothing wrong with any of that stuff, but the conversation has gotten wider and wider and wider. And then we realize that, oh, it's not just file size. It's like how long things take to execute. And I don't know. It's a huge world, web performance. So when we do this show, the point is I thought we'd get some guests on to talk about performance because they're all think and worry about web performance too, but from a different kind of slice of the pie. So these are just, you know, I don't know. All together, it's all web performance. I want to paint a broad picture of web performance and then just talk about it for a while. You ready, Dave?
Well, Chris, who do we have on the show today?
Well, there's three guests. I'll introduce them one at a time in I guess, reverse first name alphabetical order. Meaning Zach is first. We have Zach Leatherman on the show. Hey, Zach.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
Good, 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 good. Thanks for being on the show. Zach, you're from Filament Group, yeah?
Yeah, Filament Group.
Woo! Maybe you'll recognize Filament Group as kind of leaders in thinking about all things performance. That's kind of the mantra over there, isn't it?
Yeah, we're really focused on performance at Filament Group. We try to make our clients' websites as fast as possible so they can sell as much stuff as they can, so.
Yay. And Zach, I would say you've been for years now talking about specifically about fonts. You know, I'm sure that your knowledge of web performance is deep and wide, but are known and have talked at conferences and stuff specifically about fonts. And like, it's just not exactly a straightforward thing. You don't just load up at FontFace these days, right? There's just the fonts and the performance equation is a little complicated.
Yeah, it is kind of hard, and a lot of people have really kind of pressured me to say, hey, can you just give us like the one silver bullet way to do it? And that's, I guess, not really something I can do because there's so many different aspects to even just web font loading. So, yeah, I've written a lot of blog posts about it. I've studied a lot about it, so anxious to talk more about it today.
Yeah, and you know, so that's what I mean by like narrow slice of the pie. Like nobody's arguing that the number one thing you need to consider with web performance is fonts necessarily, but it's like it's certainly a part of the equation, and even it as narrow of a slice of the pie it is a complicated thing to talk about. So we'll get into all that. We have more guests though. I guess if we're going reverse first name chronological order, that's Jack next. We have Jack Doyle here. Hey, Jack.
Hey guys,
I know Jack from Jack is the creator, proprietor, part of the team at Green Sock. Yeah,
that's me. Yep, exactly. We kind of live and breathe animation stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So Green Sock is maybe pitch us on it real quick so we know what's up.
Green Sock. Well, we kind of came from the Flash days and doing crazy animation stuff, and then made the hop over to HTML5 and. And so anything you want to animate pretty much on a web page, you can use GSAP. GSAP stands for Green Sock Animation Platform. So some people know it as TweenMax or TweenLite, and there's all that kind of fun stuff. But basically anything animated is, you know, you can reach for Green Sock.
Lots of people out there are saying if you want performant animations, Green Sock is the way to go. Even Google themselves, I believe, have said, have given you that badge.
They have. Yep.
That's pretty cool. And I was at a conference not so long ago, the last CSS DevComp, in which there was a talk all about this concept of perceived performance. And the person who gave that talk was Eli Fitch. Eli is here too. Hey, Eli.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Which is just a very interesting slice of the pie. I think you were quoted in part of that talk, the only kind of performance that matters, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like if a website is slow in the woods and no one can hear it, did it really fall or something like that, right?
I believe that was Ben Franklin.
Yeah, I thought it was Alexander Hamilton, but I think you might be right. I think okay. It might be Ben Franklin, yeah.
Yes.
So can you pitch us on explain the concept of perceived performance a little bit more for it?
Well, yeah, it's like, especially in now that we live in this world where web performance has gotten so much more attention and people are taking care of dotting their I's and crossing their T's so much more, that we really have to start answering the question, is taking care of all of this low-hanging fruit and focusing on making our web pages faster if our users can even tell the difference, and if they can tell the difference, how much can they tell the difference? And sort of analyzing, instead of the objective speed up that we're achieving, like getting it to load 400 milliseconds faster, like seeing how much users perceive it increasing in speed becomes a little bit more important, because it's really their experiences and their memories of the experiences that impact whether the sites that we're making are going to be successful and whether people will hang on to that positive experience and go back to that site and help that site make more money or whatever that site's goal is.
Yeah. I always think of when the topic of perceived performance is like, I don't know, what I think of when I think of that is like trickery, is like the, but it's perhaps it's more than that, but it's kind of like if I do this, if I use a little animation over here, if I make the loading spinner Tetris or something, that I'm distracted from the actual performance and like in my mind time went by faster and thus the website felt faster. But, so that I mean
some of it can be that, and like animation can really help in that regard, but I kind of view it as understanding a little bit about the psychology of how people perceive time and how people experience things, and then using that little bit of what you understand in order to make decisions that make websites feel faster.
And there's also actual performance is perceived performance too, right? Like if you had a website that took 2 seconds to load and you made it load in 1 second, or at least like there's stuff happening, that's in that case, actual performance is perceived performance as well, right?
Yeah, it's like if actual speed, people can perceive that, then yeah, it's actual speed is perceived speed too.
Yeah, that's so. I guess that's why it feels like that seems like a true statement that all performance is perceived performance, or the only kind of performance that matters, because whatever perception is all we got. All we got.
Yeah, right.
In this world. So where do we go from here? In the spirit of perceived performance, I think that all this font stuff factors into that nicely. So I wonder if Zach, you could help us. Can we like take the first part of the show to talk about all this font loading stuff, and what do you think about it in perceived performance? Is that how you think about font loading too, is the perception of how it loads?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of ways to improve web font loading is to sort of decrease the file size and decrease the wire weight so that you decrease the amount of time the user waits to see the web font loading. And so there's a lot of different factors that go into that. So different browsers handle it differently. So some browsers will hide the text while the font is loading. And that really can negatively impact your perceived performance because the page looks blank, right? While the web font's loading. So
that's the flash of invisible text, they call it, right?
Right, yeah. Or colloquially, the FOIT. FOIT. John Voight.
So people like that, that one seems pretty bad, right? Like there's just white nothingness as a page loads. Like perception wise, I'm like angry at that happening to me, right? Like literally, I can't even read your stuff. So that's one of the things you fight against, right? Is like, it's, I guess you could go on from there. Like the alternative to that is to load the wrong font and then switch it out, right?
What do you mean load the wrong font?
Well, I mean, your alternative to not...
Talking about Comic Sans or Papyrus or... what do you mean the wrong font?
Fantasy.
Fantasy.
Well, the browser's choosing to display nothing at all if we're talking about font.
Right.
Because it doesn't have what it knows you want, which is what I call the right font, right? So if you're trying to avoid... It would show some other font. You know, I don't know if wrong font is the word to.
Well, we just want to show a system back. Font immediately. Yeah, we want to show the system font as soon as possible. We want to render that to the user so the text is immediately readable. And I think as a web developer, that flash of invisible text is just so frustrating because you know the text is there and it's parsed by the web browser. It's just hiding it from you.
So the people who are the most mad in the world about this is web developers, but I'm sure most, like anybody, could be mad at it. You're like,
sure. I mean, I'm just speaking from personal experience as a web developer. It's just so anger inducing.
Yeah, I feel it's like someone dangling a candy bar in front of you, be like up, not quite yet, not yet.
I was reading a code blog the other day, and the code loaded before like the blog post, you know.
Oh no.
So because it was just a system font in the code block, and I just was like, well, that's cool, but like zero context right now.
It's kind of like the marshmallow experiment, right? Where they set a marshmallow in front of you, And they say, if you wait 10 minutes, we'll give you 2 marshmallows, but you
and
can
a
eat
whole
that
article.
One. Right. You can eat that one now, and you get nothing.
I feel like I would turn into a marshmallow. My brain would absolutely explode if I was a kid. I have no idea where I would fall. Flip a coin.
Both my children would fail this experiment instantly.
What's funny about this font stuff is that I feel like the way browsers like used to work, I don't have any like time, so maybe years and years ago, was that it wouldn't do this invisible text thing. That's like fairly new in the spectrum of it. What it used to do is show the quote-unquote wrong font and then switch over. And that I think we can all agree, is a little annoying also, but at least the text is there, right? And so what's that has its own weird name too.
It's the flash of unstyled text, which is the foit, and the fout.
It used to be uncool and now it's cool again.
Well, that's what Internet Explorer does currently. That's what they've always done. They never switched over to making web fonts invisible. I think Chrome was the first browser to introduce that, and other browsers sort of followed suit. So if you want to blame someone, if you want to heap some blame on somebody.
Blame Chrome.
Yep.
Well, I mean, this is maybe not to harp on the designer-developer relationship, but that was kind of one big thing. It was like, let's just hide the fonts like with a body class or something until they're loaded, because the designers didn't want to see the fout, you know? So I found myself in a position where I was like kind of like hiding text per request, you know?
I think a lot of that comes from, or a lot of the web developer capitulation of that comes from sort of us thinking that there's one ideal network connection, right? We didn't really test in those times. We didn't really test on 3G and 2G connections. So it was kind of a crapshoot.
Okay. So Zach, it was 6 months ago now, you published a comprehensive guide to font loading strategies. Now that we've defined both foit and fout, and I guess in my mind, they're both kind of undesirable, but if you have to pick one, fout is better. This guide is kind of like, if you want to minimize both of them, there's all these different things that you can do, right? So, you know, again, we're talking about web performance. So like the best thing you can do is like, can you walk us through what the considerations are and what the options are?
Well, so there's a couple of different things you can do. If you want to try and eliminate both the foit and the fout, my favorite approaches is to sort of inline, using a data URI, a subset, a very small subset of your web font on the page. So you just dump a big style block with the data URI web font right in there. And that usually I only put like the alphabet and a couple of punctuation characters, maybe some numbers in there. And that will be just like a couple of kilobyte of web font content that needs to be inlined. And then you load the other web fonts that you're using on the page just as you would otherwise. So, really, you sort of eliminate most of your foit because the data URI is blocking, right? It loads.
Right. The browser hasn't even gotten to a paragraph tag by the time it already has the data it needs to display the font by the time it even gets to any text.
Right. So it has all of those, that subset of characters available. And then when we load in our much larger web fonts later, those will repaint. But the reflow for that repaint will be much less because it's only loading the extra glyphs that you hadn't used initially or you hadn't loaded initially.
And then isn't there, I imagine there's even more to it, right? It's just like now that we've loaded the larger font, now we can stash that in cache, or now that it's automatically cached so that the next time the page loads, we don't even need to inline the stuff at the top because it's not necessary anymore because the font is stashed. Is that part of the equation too? Or?
Right. I mean, a lot of the web font loading articles that I've written have really focused on that initial page load. The uncached, unprimed cache load, because that's where a lot of your gains are coming. When the font is cached, I mean, you can basically get away with just loading it normally. It's that empty cache load that is really the problem that we're dealing with.
Yeah, that's probably something we should focus on. It's easy to kind of forget that as you're working on a site, I feel like, because you have so much of your own site cached, or whatever site you're working on cached, because you're just, of course you do, you're actively working on it, you know, so it's...
Yeah, yep, and your local host is a lot faster than your production site, I'm sure.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so much of this is that first what's a good word, what to call that, the unprimed cache? Is there a cool word for that?
Empty cache, I don't know.
I call them freshies. They're called freshies. So there's cached files and freshies.
Have you played with this stuff, Eli? What's going through your mind when you're thinking about all this?
Yeah, I have. At my last job, which was at an agency, we had to deal with loading a lot of different web fonts, like sometimes 300 plus kilobytes of web fonts, and we never thought to take some of the glyphs out and inline them as a data URI, and I think that's so smart. The technique that we would use was using a system font, and then we would try and take the system font that was closest to the font that we wanted to use and change the size or weight of that system font to try and line up as closely as possible to the font that we wanted to minimize like any layout changes as the page would repaint, to sort of like minimize that shock or that jank.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's really interesting, like the whole freshy, the perceived performance around freshy sites. So much is just about getting the user into the content as fast as possible, and like finding what your sort of minimum viable layout is for your app or your site. And that's not just like above some imaginary fold that you set to like critically inline your CSS above like a certain pixel value, and then everything else is in the style sheet. It's like going through and identifying which things on the page your users interact with first and need the most, and rendering those things first and giving them to the user as quickly as possible, just those things. Yeah. And then you can bring everything else in.
It's like tab index, you know, tab index. We could just say tab index one, tab index two. We almost need like perf index one. That would be bad, probably. I'm sure we
actually did something kind of similar. We would put an attribute on the HTML element that would contain the things that we wanted to inline, rather than inlining everything through like some gulp plugin.
I'm always pleasantly surprised when the order happens to be correct. Like I was like on a plane and got to that point in the what's that? What's the like when you're on a, like a Delta flight and you're signing on to the internet or whatever, like Sky Wi-Fi or whatever it is. I forget.
Go in-flight.
Go Air. And like it needs you to do a CAPTCHA at the last thing you can do before you're online. And it's like I was like nothing on this page matters except for the CAPTCHA and the input that I need to type it in, and they're always the first thing to load. I'm like, good job. That is the first thing that needs to load. I definitely don't need to wait for your logo to download before the CAPTCHA arrives. So.
Isn't that kind of what preload is, though?
Oh, maybe.
A little bit.
But what's the order of preload?
There's a neat new feature. I don't know if it's new or whatever, in DevTools and for Chrome, and you can right click on that timeline thing, the waterfall, and see the priority of resources, like high, low, 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 high, medium. It's been cool for me to kind of look at that and see see what the browser, one particular browser, thinks is important to load and in what order. It's interesting. Like, what if you did nothing? It loads pretty smart. But I also find myself like kind of getting, this is maybe getting into the perceived performance, but like doing a lot of tricks to try and trick the browser to load something faster, like lazy loading iframes, lazy loading images, lazy loading fonts, style sheets, everything.
Oh, don't get me started about lazy loading fonts, Dave.
That's what I want to, that's where I wanted to take this for a minute, because I feel like sometimes what we're trying to do in this order is just like, I don't care, just or just later, you know, like just, I feel like that's how JavaScript became for a while, right? Like just put it at the bottom or put async attributes on it, because it just, I want it to load, but just whenever later. And that's like not necessarily great for fonts, right? You wouldn't just like toss an async on your font CSS, right? Because then you're guaranteed fout every single time. Isn't that the
case? I mean, so when you lazy load a style sheet, it's different than lazy loading a font. So they're two kind of related things, but they're not as tightly coupled as a lot of people think. So when you lazy load, when you lazy load a style sheet, it will lazy load that font face block, but the font face block isn't the only thing that decides whether or not the web font loads, or the web font is loaded by the web browser. It needs actual content on your website that uses the same font family.
Oh, right.
In order for the font to load. So a lot of people don't realize that web fonts aren't actually, even if you put your font face block in the top of your header, it's still going to need to parse some body content before it will actually fetch that web font. So all you're doing when you lazy load a web font, or when you lazy load the style sheet that contains the font face block, is you're just delaying the FOIT later in your waterfall. So the user could be three paragraphs into the article and all of a sudden the text becomes invisible because you've decided to start loading the font much later in your waterfall. So I would say that's more undesirable than doing nothing. So don't lazy load your web fonts.
I feel like I talked to you, Otto, as well. I think we were at like smashing up Barcelona together or something. I admitted that I largely do nothing. In doing nothing, I mean, I just like, if I'm using at font face at the moment, like even on CSS Tricks right now, I just like use Google Fonts, just like in the prescribed way. I just import the style sheet and it just, that's it, you know?
Well, and I would say the patterns that they have on the Google Web Fonts website are anti-patterns. So you should be real careful when you use those. And the default browser behavior is getting better, but Safari 10 is the newest one that just introduced the 3-second FOIT timeout. And so every other version of Safari that exists that is less than Safari 10 doesn't have a web font timeout.
So on my current Safari, like not the brand new one, it like if a web font's going to take 10 minutes to load from some slow server, users won't see my stuff
ever.
Right. So my Google font. If the request hangs, nothing will get rendered.
Wow.
And you have to basically reload the page because the stop button doesn't actually cancel the request. It doesn't actually stop it and render with the fallback font. You have to reload the entire page to get that.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding, or maybe this is a little bit of like a semantic thing, but when you were talking about your strategy of sort of like a two-stage font loading process of like inlining the, I guess, critical glyphs or just the alphabet and then bringing in the rest of the web font like data and glyphs and punctuation that you need later, it's not necessarily lazy loading in the sense that you're making an AJAX request for that stuff. You're just loading it when your CSS is loaded and when the browser gets to an element that needs that font. But isn't that sort of lazy loading, like the main portion of your font?
It is, but with those approaches, you're always showing a fallback font, so you're never showing invisible text.
Got it.
And when we talk about lazy loading, when it comes to default browser behavior, or lazy loading without as sort of an alternative font loading strategy, that's sort of just coupled with the default font loading behavior. So you're lazy loading the style sheet. You're not lazy loading the web font, I guess, is the main distinction.
I gotcha. Great point.
So I wonder if there's an animation connection between all this. Like, can you like inline tween light and then lazy load tween max?
I haven't seen that done a whole lot.
yeah.
No, I mean, the whole tween light, tween max thing is interesting in the sense that, you know, originally we had, for those that aren't familiar with it, tween max is kind of like the big beefy tweening engine that has, you know, all the bells and whistles. But, you know, some people, they don't need all the bells and whistles. Maybe they're just going to be doing some kind of canvas animation. They're not needing to animate CSS of DOM elements. And so they just need the lightest weight thing. And so that's where tween light comes in. But, you know, in the modern web, you know, we have all these CDNs and caching and that kind of fun stuff. And so, you know, back to Eli's point of perceived performance, sometimes if tween max is out there on all these CDNs and it's the most used piece of the platform, and it's, you know, widely cached. And so it's essentially, I don't want to call it free in terms of load times, but, you know, if it's already cached so widely, is it really smarter to go with TweenLite in that case, since TweenMax gives you all the bells and whistles anyway? It can actually take you longer to load TweenLite, even though it's a smaller file, when you factor in the wide caching and the CDNs and all that kind of stuff.
So you're talking about cross-site caching even, just like how, whatever, I load the Lotto font from, because I use Slack, I already have it loaded, and then I go to some other site that uses Lotto and I don't need to download it because they're both, the URL both points to Google Fonts, so I already got it kind of thing. Is that, that's
exactly, yeah. Yeah, if you use the main, you know, CDN, that's the common one, then various sites can point to the same file, and so it becomes, you know, widely cached. And GSAP is used in a lot of ads, you know, banner ads and that kind of thing. So obviously those are on various sites, and so the, you know, every major ad network has TweenMax on their CDN, and, you know, they kind of enforce, they tell people to point to that CDN, so any ad thereafter, it becomes so widely cached that it's essentially free on that ad network, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So when you are talking about perform, like the word performance to you means something kind of different. It's less about like how quick does it load on that page and spit out things. Yours is more, you know, frame rates and layout thrashing and stuff like that. Is that how you kind of?
Yeah, that's a great point, because there's definitely the two aspects. You know, one is just the get it down the wire and into the browser, and I actually think it is important, but it's probably less important than the runtime performance, because, you know, if you could load something that's, let's say, 9 kilobytes cheaper, you know, then the web page performs kind of jankly, and, you know, the animations are a little jerky. You know, is that a really good trade-off? You know, would that 9 kilobytes take an extra, you know, 100 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds or something to load on the average for the average user? And, you know, so you got to look at what are the trade-offs. And so we've focused a lot on the runtime performance, because I think that's the most, animation is the most performance-sensitive aspect of UX. And so, you know, your eye can pick up on the little drop in frame rate, and it's kind of annoying. I'm sure we've all experienced that before. And so, you know, there's choices that we had to make in the code when writing the JavaScript that actually made it longer. So there's more code, but it runs faster. You know, at runtime.
That's an interesting trade-off, right? Like, this library is bigger, but it, through its bigness, you know, which is a hit to performance theoretically, because it's more bytes of code or whatever, but it makes it run smoother.
Yeah, it's like a I don't know, a faster bad experience or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, well, and then the user,
a slower,
like,
better, okay, experience.
Yeah, because like slower, better experience or faster, worse experience, because you're sort of, I don't know. I mean, hopefully this isn't just a straw man that we're debating endlessly, but I could see very much how, like, you could, you know, cut some corners and it could start, you know, I don't know, dropping FPS. Cause I think that's kind of the sustained use. When people use GSAP, it's for these kind of epic animations, right? Like, so if you see the little, I don't know, car kind of herk, you know, onto your screen, pitifully, it doesn't make you want to buy a Mercedes or a BMW. No,
I like how Jack said that performance is the most performance sensitive thing. That kind of feels right to me, almost like at least neck and neck with font loading anyway. And it's true that if you see a jerky animation, you're like, oh, way red flag.
Yep, oh, exactly.
One of the great like mind shares that I wish that the web community could come together with is around performance with game developers, because game developers have to deal with a lot of the same things in terms of like loading a lot of information into RAM the first time you open a game. They have to deal with a lot of like long asynchronous loading times when you enter a new level or something in the game changes. And obviously, they deal with a lot of like animation, a lot of 3D games and stuff. It's all animation. And like one of the things that I picked up that helped my sort of like understanding of perceived performance around web animations the most when I started doing game development is the idea that slow frame rates are more desirable than jerky frame rates. That if it's slow but steady, that's less jarring to users than if something is mostly performant but then has like weird drops. And that's one of the great things that I think that like a library like GSAP can give you, right? Sort of smooth, steady frame rates.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have 60 FPS for, you know, some time and then it drops to like 5 FPS, then you're right. The eye picks up on that more than if you just said run it 30 frames per second the whole time.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Rollbar. That's rollbar.com/shoptalkshow. That's the URL you want to go to get 3 months of their bootstrap plan for free. Rollbar is all about error tracking. It does an amazing job of that. So you know, it's really easy to integrate too, and it integrates into any application, you know, JavaScript, which is Ember, Angular, Backbone, Node.js, or your Ruby stack with Rails, .NET, PHP, even Flash, iOS, anything. They've got it all covered. You put it in there and it starts capturing the errors that your app throws, which it's definitely throwing some, believe me, and lets you know about them. So not only so you need to know what these errors are in order to fix them, gives you the stack trace and all that, it groups them intelligently too. So if your app is like throwing like thousands of this one kind of error, but it's kind of minor, it's good to know. It's good to not get an email about every single time that error happens thousands of times. That's annoying. You know you need to fix it, but maybe it's lower priority than some other kind of bug, and allows you to prioritize and that type of thing. It integrates with like Slack and Jira tickets and all that type of stuff too, so you kind of get to decide like, okay, put this type of error here or whatever. It allows you to, you know, gives you the information you need to fix the errors that are happening in your app and prioritize them and know about them, but not be too annoyed by them, stuff like that. Just a couple of lines of code to integrate into your app, whatever that app is. Oh, it's kind of amazing software. Thank you, Rollbar. Again, the URL is rollbar.com/shoptalkshow. $87 value to sign up for their bootstrap plan for free. I feel like that like it's widely cached thing. I guess to be honest with you, I thought that I remember that being highly debated like for a while and a thing. And I honestly kind of thought that was not the case anymore. I thought if the world dropped on something, it's like, it was kind of like, don't count on it anymore. Cause it was always talked about in terms of jQuery. Cause I think, as popular as GSAP is, I think jQuery kind of takes the cake for like most popular loaded library. And it's kind of like, well, I don't know. We use jQuery on CodePen, and I would feel pretty weird not bundling it with the rest of our libs. You know, like isn't the general advice still like if you're loading like some third party libs, you just should just bundle them as part of your build process and load it.
I think you're supposed to use Webpack and never analyze what went into that Webpack. I think that's the current.
It doesn't matter because
best practice. Splitting. Yeah, code splitting, Chris. Duh.
I'm still trying to understand what this jQuery thing is that you're talking about.
Yeah,
I'm just kidding. But no, that's definitely a factor out there. I mean, some people do prefer to do that. I think it's different in different worlds, like in the advertising world, which is not what GSAP is limited to, but it's definitely used pretty heavily there. You know, banner ads, they're on super tight restrictions in terms of file size. And so the caching thing becomes imperative. And so you wouldn't like bundle TweenMax inside of your ad file necessarily. It just makes a lot more sense to point to the ad servers right. CDN version of that library.
Yeah, it depends on the world you come from. That makes sense. I wonder if GreenSock didn't offer
these different libraries? Like, is almost the reason you had to create them for like, I don't know, for like marketing signaling almost? Like, I feel like it would be weird for you to have a hard line stance on like, we could make a tween light, but we're just not going to. You should just load this one. It's like you kind of have to be sensitive to people's performance needs.
Yeah, but actually, there was a Tween Nano as well in the Flash days.
Is that even and smaller? So that
was even smaller than Tween Light. Yeah, it was like, it was crazy. It was about 2 kilobytes or something. Oh, wow. And so we've been asked for that in the, you know, the JavaScript world, and we've, you know, considered it. We looked at a lot of factors, and it's like, you know what? If we do that, the downside of offering something like that is that you know, a lot of people might start using it, and then there's this weird trade-off where that starts getting widely cached, and then people end up facing this dilemma of, you know, do I use Tween Nano or Tween Max or what? And then, but if you use Tween Nano, then it doesn't have all these features that all these people want, and so I don't know. It's a tough decision. We haven't come out with Tween Nano for JavaScript for intentional reasons,
right?
But there's still Tween Light. So,
so along these same lines, isn't there? I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm just not as up to date as under the hood JavaScript processing as I should be. But like, not all 100 kilobytes or whatever of JavaScript are created the same, right? It, like, doesn't it totally depend on what loops are happening in there and what's executing and what isn't and all that stuff? Couldn't a 200 kilobyte library be wildly more efficient than a 100 kilobyte library?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's even in code legibility and, you know, it's writing elegant code oftentimes means grouping things into, you know, functions, obviously. And, you know, the more you can break things down like that, usually the better. But when it comes to the animation stuff, that can hurt you. You know, you have to try to avoid function calls whenever you can, because those can be expensive. And so inlining stuff inside of your loops becomes important. And so you look at the code and it's like, you know what? It's uglier. There's more stuff going on inside of these loops that could be broken out, but it's much more important that it's fast during runtime.
How much time do you, I mean, I guess that's just what you do, isn't it? Like writing code that you might have to use. It reminds me of like people that work on emails all day, that they just do whatever weird, bizarre tricks are necessary to make the emails work across browsers. Like, I don't care about semantics or legibility or like code maintainability or anything. Like, it's, we're just trying to get the dang thing to render right. And in all these crazy
pretty much,
email clients.
Yeah, I kind of obsess about this stuff.
And that, I mean, that would be the case for your library too, is you're, you know, there's not very many of you that like work on the main GreenSock library itself, right? It's like,
right.
If there was 50 people working on it, you'd have to worry about legibility across a team, but.
True. Yeah. It's just me. And I do kind of obsess in a scary way about this stuff. And, you know, just the other day I woke up thinking about some weird optimization with square roots, and it's I don't know, it just
there was square roots.
I don't
nightmare have fuel. What, so I, GreenSock is, I mean, it does so much. If people haven't checked it out, it's like I don't know. It, for me, it was like, oh, this makes animation simple, really complex animation simple. But when you're kind of debugging or kind of looking at the whole picture of GreenSock, are you into the, like the flame charts and all that stuff in DevTools? Does that, like, is that a critical part of your kind of evaluation?
Yeah, it definitely is. Less so recently, but yeah, when I'm into the super performance sensitive stuff, then I'm definitely cracking open DevTools and doing the recordings and checking that stuff out. You know, there's a big learning curve for me with all the, you know, the which things are, how do you get GPU acceleration on transforms and all that fun stuff. I don't know how far you want to dig into that in this episode, but yeah, there was definitely a lot of learning that had to happen and experimenting and seeing like, what are the different, how do they handle things differently in various browsers. And I kind of live in having to do this animation stuff so much in the various browsers. It's like there's so many bugs. It's kind of crazy. That's what I spend a lot of my time on, is figuring out like, oh, IE does it this way, and Firefox has this weird thing. If something is invisible and it has a transform on it, then, you know, if it's in the depths of a SVG, then that's going to throw an error, and it's just bizarre. Wait,
this is interesting. So there's like kind of a bunch of like very specific knowledge that you've accrued. Do you think most web developers like just do it wrong? Like this is maybe a broader question. Everyone, like, just do you think most people just, they're trying to code the best they can, but they probably did something ultra heinous?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that. You know, just the other day, like there was a guy who was, he was animating like 100 divs, and he was animating the width of them, the width property, the CSS, and then also at the same time, a 3D transform, like, you know, an X and a Y, or a, I can't remember if it was scale or something like that, something transform related. And, you know, that you can't fault the guy for doing that. Who most people wouldn't realize that's a quote unquote mistake. But if you change something like width, then it kind of changes the information that it has to send to the GPU. And when you 3D accelerate something to make its own layer in the browser, then it's, you know, it kind of, it's almost like taking a screenshot of that particular element and sending it off to the GPU. And then, you know, it's great for moving pixels around really fast, but if you're changing the width on every tick of animation, then it has to keep on resending. You know, think about if there was text inside of that div and then you change the width of it, all the text might reflow. Mm-hmm. And so it has to recapture that image and send it off to the GPU. So it's really slow. So it was almost crashing the browser based on how he was doing it.
Wow. And I get told all the time, oh, just throw the transform 000 on it or whatever, and it'll 3D accelerate. It's the best.
It'd be kind of interesting if GreenSock had a dev mode that would, like, anytime there's a, like, something that it's detected is almost for sure going to be slow, that it, like, console.logs, console.error, or whatever. Yeah. Like,
we put that in our CSS lint config, where, like, if you're animating or transitioning a width or any layout property, it will throw a warn in the CSS lint.
Interesting.
That's smart.
Yeah. So, I get, Eli, do you feel like, sort of, do you agree with that sentiment, like, just where most web developers, even though they're trying to do their best job, are probably just doing something awful for performance?
I mean, like, sometimes, but a lot of web developers don't spend most of their day thinking about all the cool, neat animations they're going to make. And, like, mm-hmm. to them, animating width when you want something to change its width is the way to do it. People don't think that, like, we could figure out a way to do this and scale X. And, like, sometimes that you might have to rethink how you want to structure that element in order to accommodate that, especially with, like, you know, things like accordions where you want to animate something's max height, and, like, getting that to work with transforms can be really difficult. And, like, if the accordion works fine, even if it works at 10 FPS, that's good enough. You know, I don't think it's, like, malicious, like, ha ha ha, I'm going to use jQuery.animate on this because it's going to make Jack mad.
Yeah. It's a weird part of web perf, right? Because a lot of times when we're thinking about performance and how it gets rated and the scores that you get and stuff are all related to just the loading of it. And they don't factor at all in how smoothly an accordion opens. But certainly how smoothly an accordion opens is part of the overall puzzle.
And, like, perceived performance, it's all really, I mean, like, if we want to get super in the weeds, at the end of the day, it really is all about just, like, user satisfaction. And if a website that is supposed to feel smooth and polished and professional and has motion that isn't smooth and polished, it tarnishes the type of message that you're trying to convey to your users, and you're, like, subverting the whole point of what you're trying to accomplish with your site.
Or even if you get an A for your whatever, like, web perf testing tool you're using, you get some smoking fast time to glass, but the way that you got there was by, like, Ajax loading some garbage library at the end that does a bad job of animation well after the page is loaded entirely, it's like, yeah, you got an A, but your the usability perf still sucks.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by CodePen Pro. CodePen.io/pro is the page that explains all of the different pro features that you get on CodePen. One really simple, obvious one, the number one pro feature when we ask people why they upgraded on CodePen is private pens. You can keep your work private. Work on CodePen without anybody seeing what you're up to until you're ready for them to see it. Of course, a pen could stay private forever. You can always share a private pen and have people see it. It's just nobody else will be able to find it unless you share it with them, because they have big, crazy, secret-looking URLs that programmatically nobody could ever guess. There's big stuff. There's collab mode and asset hosting and all kinds of big stuff. There's just little stuff, too. Like, you know, you have a profile on CodePen. Do you want to use another pen as the header of your profile on CodePen? We just make that a pro feature because it's just a fun little bonus for being pro on CodePen. Again, that's codepen.io/pro. So do you find this stuff fun? Let's do a roundtable on that, Dave. Like, do you know
is performance fun?
Once in a while, like, you know, once in a while, do you think of performance like every day, or do you go on little sprints on it? Let's go around the circle, but we'll start with Dave. Like, do you find it fun? B, what do you do when it's perf day?
You know, it's fun. It's also aggravating. I've had like experiences where like I feel like I made a really awesome improvement and nothing happens. You know, like the one we've talked about on Shop Talk before is I removed jQuery from my site and I was like, and web fonts. And I was like, hell yeah, this is going to be the fastest website on the internet. And it was slower in like on my speed index. And I just don't get it. It might've been my ads or comments or something, but it was slower. And I just was like, I hate everything. So
I demand satisfaction.
Yeah. So anyway, that's like, it's fun, but like can be aggravating. And you know, it's like, you can also get like very sucked into one micro factor, one micro optimization. And I always have to be careful, but anyway, but performance days, like where you get to optimize like something, that's fun. It's fun because you feel like you're cleaning house. You're just, yeah. Anyway,
Zach, fun or not fun?
I love it, man. I don't know. It's fun. I think to Dave's point, it is easy to get sort of stuck in the weeds on one specific aspect of it. And that's kind of why we use tools like Webpage Test to give us sort of the screenshot view. And I think Chrome DevTools has added the screenshot view as well. So you can sort of see how your pages look while they're loading, because a lot of times it's impossible to slow down your eyeballs enough that you'll be able to see every individual step. So just the screenshot view has been really helpful to me just to see how things are loading and how to sort of work on prioritizing the right things for page load.
Does screenshot view work with throttling too?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. So you set, you know, you probably set it at 3G and then fire it off and see what you get.
Yep.
And I forgot. I think we know actually, I don't know what Jack's going to say. You find yourself deep in the weeds, but how, you know, like, are the weeds fun or?
You know, when I was 15, I think my stepdad gave me a riddle and I sat there for literally like a few hours just thinking about this riddle, and I had to solve it, and I eventually solved it, and it was very satisfying. And you know, he kept asking me like, well, do you want me to just tell you the answer? And I'm like, no, don't tell me the answer. I have to figure this out myself. And so I love the
frog in a blender
aspect of, yeah, I like solving the problems. I like figuring this stuff out. But what I can't stand are the browser bugs and the, you know, it's like today Chrome is great, and then you know the next day they introduce some new thing that breaks something, and it's like, you know, that's very frustrating to work around. So that I don't enjoy, but the rest of it is like a riddle, and I love it.
Yeah, I think that I like the riddle. You know, it reminds me of cross browser compatibility, which is another, like, you know, that was like another like thing we battled for so long and still battle sometimes. And it's like some people find it highly not enjoyable at all.
Like, what? I want to build the thing. I don't want to care about how five different browsers interpret my thing and like battle them. And some people found it fun. I think the Riddle people found it like, oh, this is just a weird arbitrary challenge that I shall overcome. I have more questions, but we'll do Eli first. You gave a whole talk on performance, so I hope you enjoy it a little.
I would say that I would say yes and no. As I started delving into more about perceived performance and like understanding the psychology behind how users sense time and perceive websites, it started to get a little less fun and a little more scary. As once I realized that, yeah, it was spooky. Once I realized that that users have trouble sensing differences in time that are 20% or less, it started giving me a lot of doubt about whether this was really a good use of my time and effort. Like, if I can improve the speed of this already fast website by 15%, will anybody notice and will anybody care? And if the answer is no, well, that kind of sucks. But on the other hand, like doing stuff like optimizing animation performance and like coming up with clever new ways to get rid of a width or height animation and convert it to a transform so it runs butter smooth, that is super, super satisfying.
I mean, we didn't talk as much about the perceived performance stuff. Was there like a killer case study that you found or some like really cool perceived performance trick or something that you could walk us through that was like, I don't know, the keystone of your talk?
I would say that just understanding the difference of between like an active mental state and a passive mental state and how users overestimate time spent in passive states, which is any sort of mental state characterized by low mental activity, like waiting for something would be a passive state. And people overestimate that time by like 36%. And so that started getting me thinking, well, then really perceived performance is all about keeping people active and engaged while they're using your product, right? And that can mean on a freshy page load, getting people into content as soon as possible and making sure that you're rendering first the things that people are going to use first. And then with asynchronous content, it can get really, really interesting thinking about how can I start loading this stuff asynchronously before people even know that they're going to need it. And that's kind of where I veered off in my talk into this idea of predictive design, which is studying patterns of user behavior and understanding that if a user takes this action on a page, like moves their mouse into this zone of the page on a heat map, or like hovers this button, or even looks at this product, that they are going to be highly likely to look at this or access or use this next specific feature after that, then you can preload all of the resources that that second thing needs before they even take the action to trigger that second thing. So like example that I've used before on a couple sites when I'm loading like big 3D models for people to use, which can be really, really large because it's a lot of images and a lot of data that have to be loaded. Start that loading process the minute people mouse over the preview image, before they even get to mousing over the button and before they even click the button to show the thing. Because our heat map showed that 80% of users who put their mouse in this zone ended up clicking the button. And to me, that's enough. That's enough, like, percentage of people to take the risk that they might not end up loading it. And then that means the vast majority of people get to see that content so much faster. And they feel like it loads instantaneously, like they're never waiting at all.
Mm-hmm. So you could almost, like, even, I'm thinking of, like, a more basic example, like the search box or something. If somebody clicks in the search box, you could fire off a request to render the search results page like a empty one. And so when you finally get that request, it should load instantly, sort of.
Yeah, absolutely. And like the UI and JavaScript that's necessary to do any like auto completion stuff, you could start rendering that if someone's on the tab index before the search box, or if somebody's cursor gets close to the search box.
Oh, the tab index before the search box. That blows my mind a little bit. Because you're like you're trying to guess, but it's like a smart way to guess.
Yeah, and like, it's all about studying user patterns and studying user behavior, and really like having that like relationship and understanding with the people who are using your app.
I tried to recently because there's some kind of like fast click whatever something where it was kind of like, oh,
your mouse button is hovered over a link, so there's a good chance you're going to click on that link. So why not fire off like a pre-render for that URL? So I wrote it up because it's like a trivial amount of JavaScript to write, right? Because all you need to do is a link rel equals pre-render href that URL. And so I just, you know, wrote the JavaScript that would slug that element into the head when you rolled it over, but it doesn't work. So I guess it doesn't, Chrome doesn't like dynamically added rel equals pre-render tags.
Yeah, I find that I don't like using pre-render, pre-fetch, or pre-load tags because browsers support them differently and they use those tags differently. And it's really kind of like up to the browser to decide when it wants to or when it is ready to load those resources asynchronously. I like to make straight up AJAX requests, and you can make those requests on your own terms, rather than leaving it up to the browser to determine whether it makes the request or not.
So you, like on CodePen, it could be like new pen dot on hover or whatever.
Yeah.
New well, pen that, button dot on hover.
I think that's the reason that that feature exists, is that like maybe on some websites, there's certain pages that are like almost sure that you're going to hit or are really, really important to be fast. And you wouldn't do it for like 50 pages, but you do it for one. And that's probably one we would do on CodePen, is right, like pre-render the editor. So if you hit the home page, the chances are you're going to click onto a pen, and it's a lot of that's been pre-rendered, so you would hit it. So we haven't actually done it, but because I don't know, like it depends. Like, do you pre-render the blank editor? Because doesn't it depend on what's inside the editor? I don't know.
I think it all depends on, you know, what pattern your users seem to exhibit.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I could see that.
Oh, you have to care about users.
Gross.
This whole thing. bunch of Jeffrey Zeldmans over here. All right. I have a question. Maybe, Chris, we're kind of getting to like the 1 hour mark here. So maybe I'll kind of wrap it up. One question I kind of have is like, performance is never done. You know, despite your best efforts, you made the perfect website. Somebody or tens of somebodies come through and ruin all your great progress. So what are strategies to staying on top of performance? And maybe we'll just go around the horn one more time, reverse alphabetical. Zach, what's your strategy to stay on top of performance for all of your sites, even like, cause you have dozens of properties.
Well, just in terms of keeping up to date on different technologies that are coming out, or what do you mean by the question?
Well, how do you stay up to date on like web perf, the culture, I guess? And then how do you stay up on just keeping your websites tuned and performant?
Well, I think a lot of times performance is just ongoing, right? So you have to, for me to keep up to date with new stuff that's coming out, it's kind of following the right people online, right? So
do you want to name drop anybody?
Well, I mean, my colleague, Scott Gell, just wrote a great blog post about how he reworked filamentgroup.com with H2 and service workers and all that sort of new stuff that's coming out. And it's a great post. I would encourage you to check it out. It's really about having the social connections to know kind of what's a good thing to study and what's not.
So. I bet you're going to have to think about server push, right? Because doesn't server push in a sense replace that kind of like inline head action? Because it's kind of like the request is going to come. If you tell it to server push a font, it's going to come with the HTML. So it might be a replacement for that.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, there was a big discussion on Twitter about that last week. So I know Yoav Weiss is working on that with preload and server push and all that stuff. So he's another good person to follow for sure.
I was just, one of the things is just even remembering what the right thing to do is sometimes. Like maybe I'm just getting old or whatever, but I was like, I installed some new WordPress plugin and I was like, oh crap, I got to go in there and do the thing where I like
make sure it doesn't load an extra style sheet because that's just one more HTTP request. I'm already bundling my CSS with some other tool anyway, so let me make sure I unqueue it and load the CSS in the other way I'm using it. And oh, it loads a JavaScript library too, so let me do that same process for it and make sure it's bundled with all the rest of the CSS so I'm not like imparting the pain of loading yet another library. And then I'm like, oh, wait, but like I switched to H2, so doesn't that like not matter anymore or whatever? And like, does it really not matter, or what's the limit, or how do I test which one? And
like, yeah, so you always got to keep your testing tools working for you. So web page test is invaluable, again, just to compare the screenshots. So so you can make a bunch of different changes and sort of measure the holistic impact of those changes to your website and see how they render every 100 milliseconds or whatever. See what that perceived rendering is. Or that progressive rendering is, excuse me.
Let's keep going around the horn. Jack, you're kind of maybe from a different angle, but just how, like, I create an animation, and how do I, like, make sure, like, whatever, this cool thing is always doing well and performing well? How do you stay on top of it?
Well, you're talking about for users, or what do I typically do?
Well, what do you typically do when you make things?
Well, I'll live in DevTools and do those recordings and check out the data. But as far as keeping up with things, I may be a little weird. It can be overwhelming to me. I subscribe to various newsletters and that type of thing, and there's 5 new libraries coming out every week, and then there's some hot new thing, and then 5 months later it's not really hot anymore, and it's nobody's developing it anymore, and it's like it can be hard for me to keep up with everything. So I tend to wait until there's a critical mass, and I hear about something enough mm-hmm. to then say, okay, I better look into this. And I'll do a lot of just testing. I'm one of those guys that just beats his head against the computer screen and tries to push things to the limits and animate 5,000 things at the same time and see what happens in various browsers, and what if I change this and what if I change that? So a lot of experimenting.
Cool. I probably have 100 questions about your testing environment, but let's go to Eli. What do you do to kind of stay on top of performance and all that?
Well, I think that Zach and Jack had some great thoughts when it came to like how to keep up with all of the things that are happening in web perf land. But to just keep going on tests for a second, when like I'm maintaining my personal site, which has like some WebGL stuff in it, and I'd like to do a lot of WebGL things and like have for work and stuff. One of the things that I've found has been really helpful is to include performance tests in your automated testing suite that happens every time you push a commit or merge a branch or something like that, just to make sure that it's just to make sure that you're able to set a budget that your commit won't go through if it pushes your page load time in your like web driver tool or whatever tool you use to do your like browser testing. If it pushes your load time past a certain amount, the commit won't go through. Or if it hurts your frame rate too much, it won't let you push to GitHub or whatever you use. And I found that to be really helpful in terms of keeping large teams honest when it comes to respecting the performance budget, because it kind of takes that sort of like human fallibility out of the question, and it's up to the computer to determine if something is like up to your standards or not.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Oh, by the way, I neglected to mention there's a really cool resource called CSSTricks.com. Mm. If you guys are aware of it, but it's good for keeping up on stuff.
Does it have a hyphen?
I think it has a hyphen in it.
Okay.
I should have removed that hyphen and save a byte of code.
Yeah.
Performance. Come on, Chris.
Performance, Chris. Don't worry. It auto completes in everyone's browsers. Oh, man.
Yeah, that was really wonderful. Hopefully we all got a lot of information from different walks of performance life or whatever. That was my goal, and I got it. I know I got it.
I know. I'm going to go, this whole thing, I'm like, I'm going to go sign up for like one of those like Speed Curve websites or something like that. But yeah.
Isn't Speed Curve is a good one. I use Or is it speed? No, it's speed test. Oh. That is the one that does your that tests your internet right this second. It is speed curve, isn't it?
Yeah, I used speed curve at my last job, and we found it to be immensely, immensely helpful.
It's a really good one. I use both benchmarking. It and Calibre is another one. CalibreApp.com.
Calibre.
They're similar.
And then didn't somebody do like a open sourcey kind of speed monitor?
Yeah, exactly. That was published on CSS Tricks of like, let's say you think speed curve and Calibre are both cool, but they both cost money, which is, you know, whatever. Maybe you have zero budget for some project. It's like kind of how to make a similar-ish thing to both those apps. Because I think both of them rely on the web page test like API. The web page test is a great website, but it also has like an open source version that you can install yourself. And it has an API, and you can like install it yourself and use your own version of its API. You know what I mean? I know that was a lot of information there, but I think the way SpeedCurve and Calibre work is like they run web page test APIs on their own servers, I think. And like that's what the article on CSS Tricks was, is install a local copy of web page test APIs and then use its APIs to and like build your own charts and stuff. So then all you're paying for is, I think you can get away with using a free Heroku instance basically for it.
Nice. Well, cool. Well, before we go, we should go around the horn one more time. Oh my gosh. Reverse alphabetical order. Please. If people aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that, Zach Leatherman?
Well, I blog on my website, zachleet.com, at zachleet at Twitter, and you can check out my employer's website at filamentgroup.com.
There you go. Jack, how can people follow you and give you money?
You can mail a personal check to...
Yes.
No, I'm just kidding. You can
yes.
just go to greensock.com. On Twitter, it's at greensock. Pretty easy.
Again, can't recommend it enough. Eli, how can people follow you and give you money?
I am at Eli Fitch on like all the things, and my website is eli.wtf. You can give me money by going to that website and slowly cramming dollar bills into your CD drive.
Okay, cool. You know, I got, okay, it says log error paper jam, but we'll figure this out.
Your browser must not support the paper bills API.
Yes. Does iPhone 7 have CD?
Let's see. I don't see it. All right. Well, cool. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Be sure to Starheart favorite this up in your podcatcher of choice. That's how people find out about the show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter for tens of tweets a month at Shop Talk Show. If you hate your T-shirt, head over to shoptalkshow.com/shop, I believe, and get a new T-shirt. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one because people want to hire you. Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
ShopTalkShow.com.